Tonight we've got Tony T here. Tony's in the house.
Thank you, Tim.
Being a quasi-entertainer, I know to speak into the microphone. I am Tony Taylor, and I'm an alcoholic. The date of my last drink is December the 7th, 1981. That was the last day that me and Pearl Harbor got bombed. I was the firstborn of five boys. Oh, I must mention that my sponsor, Terry G, is over here, and my fiance, Allison S, is over here. If I don't do that, I'll be in trouble. I was the firstborn of five boys to Larry and Martha T, who drank some, quite a bit. And I did not like being there from the very beginning. I didn't like living in the house. I didn't like the ensuing four brothers that I acquired. I kind of liked my mama, but I mean, I did like my mama, but everything else I could do without. And so we grew up with a great deal of, shall we say, dysfunction. And we grew up kind of in Kirkwood, and then we moved over off of Glenwood Road, the old Glenwood Drive-In. And I was a so-so student in school. I was more apt to cut up and cut jokes than actually learn anything. And somewhere around the age of 10, 11, I started running away from home, kind of testing it out. And I would live in various and sundry homes in the neighborhood. And the women in the neighborhood sort of knew what was going on in my home, so they didn't mind taking me in for a week or two here and there. So I kind of had a route I'd go around. I'd stay at one. And usually the husband would run me off after he discovered that I was actually staying there. They didn't know it, you know. The husbands usually went to bed, and they saw me when they went to bed, but they figured I went home afterwards, but I didn't. I stayed there all night, but they were up and gone to work and didn't realize it till a week or two later, and then they said, you got to go home. So that's kind of the way I spent a couple of years. Somewhere around the age of 12, maybe 13, I left for good, and oftentimes I lived on the streets, in neighbors' homes, in the back seats of cars. I had a little alarm clock wind up to wake me up before they would get up and go to work so they wouldn't find me in their car, although sometimes my alarm clock didn't work, and they would find me sleeping in their car, and oftentimes they'd carry me down to the store and give me a little money for breakfast. I continued to go to school living on the streets like that. They used to have Goodwill and Salvation Army boxes in a lot of places, and it had that little flap where you put the clothes. Well, I'd look around, you know, in the evening, and nobody was looking. I'd dive over into it, and I'd spend the night in there. And the next morning, I'd lift the flap, get a little daylight, see some good, clean clothes, and I'd put them on. And actually, my eighth grade high school yearbook picture was I was wearing a red and white polo shirt that I got out of that Goodwill box. And I began to drink. Probably, I think probably the first beer I ever had, because we used to collect Coca-Cola bottles on the side of the road, Glenwood Road, Covington Highway, and we started out getting a penny a piece for them, and then they jacked it up 100%. We got 2 cents a piece for them. And we used to walk down the road, and occasionally we would find some beer or even something else. But that's probably where I had my first drink. And I do remember that we drank them real fast so that we could burp up a lot of foam. You know what I'm saying? That was the most fun we had with it back then. But when I hit around, now there are other things that I did outside of alcohol, but my 285 was alcohol. On ramps were other things. I mean, I could do these other things, but it was all leading me to a drink. And I began to do all these other things. But I always had a beer in my hand. As a matter of fact, my brother told me when I sobered up, he said, you know, we never had a picture of you without a beer in your hand. And now I hardly ever have a picture of me without a cup of coffee in my hand. But I started getting into lots of trouble. I quit high school when I a week before I finished the year out. And well, hello, Isaac. You gotta love Isaac. Hey, Rusty. So I quit high school. They kicked me out, and I decided not to go back. And I was living with some people like me. I was about to say some lower than life people, but we were all basically in the same boat. And I'm also a recovering thief. If it wasn't nailed down, even if it's nailed down, if I could get it up real easy, it'd go too. But that's kind of that was my avocation was, you know, and I never had a problem with getting a drink because you discover early on that the guy behind the counter at the Tenneco can't run out of the parking lot. He can only run to the edge, and then he's got to turn around and go back in. And I was faster than him, even with 2 12-packs. So I drank a lot of beer, and often I was up till 3 or 4 in the morning. Now, let me give you a warning. Some of you who own your own homes, some of these homes have a utility room, and you don't lock them. And somebody like me comes along in the middle of the night and opens the door, and all you got to do is do like that, and you find the string. So you close the door, and you do like that, you find the string, pop the light on, and then you look around and see which power tools you're going to take and sell. And that's how I made a living. I had a little place over in Belvedere Plaza where it was a little barber college. And I would go in the next morning and line power sanders, drills, saws, and line them against the wall, and they would bid on them. They knew where I got them, but they didn't care. So I'd sell them $5, $10, whatever, and then they'd fund me for the rest of the day. And that's kind of how I made my living, was stealing, and once I had enough money, then I could drink and do those other things the rest of the day. Well, somewhere around the age of just before I turned 18, it all caught up with me. And they say, now it's probably true, but they say I burglarized 9 houses back to back. Bam, 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 on this street. And I can distinctly remember hiding in the shrubbery. I had a cotton picking bag. You know what that is? Big old long. And I had a cotton picking bag, and it was full of power tools, 8-track tape players, and stuff. And I was dragging it across this corner yard, headed up to where I'd already unloaded it once in an apartment where a bunch of people were passed out. And they, about 7-9 police cars pulled up and surrounded the house. And I ran. And there was a chain link fence, and I couldn't get over that. And they were over there, and they were over there, so I ran behind the shrubbery against the brick wall of the house. And I stood there. And you could see my legs at the bottom. So they said, come on out, son, and I just stood there. They're just bluffing. You know, later on when I went, I mean, years later, I went back and looked at it, and it was kind of comical. I'm standing back. It's obvious I'm back there. They can see my legs, you know, but I'm thinking that I'm just invisible. So anyway, we went through all of that, and they sentenced me to 10 years, and I went up to a little place called Alto, and I decided when I got there that my problem was drugs. That's my problem. And I'll just quit those. And basically I did for the most part. But see, I always knew that alcohol was there, so, and that wasn't included in the other deal. So I stayed there about 4 years, and they let me out. And I went to a little halfway house in Atlanta, and eventually I got out, and I went back to working with a brick mason. And anybody know brick masons drink? They love to drink. And my boss didn't care if I drank. As long as I did a very good job, and I was there, and of course I worked twice as hard so I could drink on the job. And we'd drink from early in the morning till we got off work, and then we'd go fishing and drink, and then we'd go to the pool hall and drink, and then somewhere around 2 or 3 in the morning I'd pass out. And I'd get up and go to work the next day and do it all over again. But I still like to steal. And, you know, Friday and Saturday nights, things get lonely late at night. You know, the pool hall shuts down and nowhere to go. So I go wandering and easy picking. So I started funding myself that way again. And, well, this one's going to be fun. So one night I'm renting this apartment. And I was very hungry. You know what the munchies are. So I decided that I wanted some toasted cheese peanut butter crackers. That's what I wanted. Now, I had a refrigerator full of submarine sandwiches that the store had given me. They were out of date. And they were pretty good, actually. But I wanted some peanut butter crackers. And I didn't know what time it was. I figured it was about 10 p.m. You know, I was going to walk up to the little store. Now, this is an apartment complex that the entrance has got a little store at the entrance. And then next to that is a skating rink. And then next to that is a kinder care center. So I went up to the store, and it was closed. And I thought, damn, I didn't know it was 4 in the morning. So I went walking by the skating rink, and I thought, they got to have one of them little machines in there, you know. So I went up to the doors, and they had 2 sets of double doors, you know. And I thought, I don't want to break 2 sets. So then I stared at the kinder care place, and I thought, you know, kids love peanut butter. I bet they got peanut butter. So, and it's one of these deals where they got windows all the way around it, just one floor and all the way around it. So I thought, one of them's got to be open. So I went down the whole side there, and they were all locked. Came around that first one on the back corner, there was cardboard where the window's supposed to be. I mean, the whole window. I said, how neat is that? So I just put the cardboard back, went in. And see, this is just social drinking here. So I went on in, and I remember just looking around at all the little bitty tables and little bitty chairs and stuff and toys. And I went in and had a little kitchenette, and I started going through the cabinets, and there was a whole bunch of cough syrup, and I drank all of it. It wasn't a high-powered kind, but I drank it. It was like 8 bottles of it. And then I proceeded to look for peanut butter, just social drink, you know. And right there up under the kitchen sink, there was one of them big old huge tubs of Lennox Park peanut butter. And I found some white bread, and I made them suckers as fat as a Fuddruckers burger. So I remember chewing them, gone. And I drank the milk, you know. Thing is, when I finished up, I cleaned all the dishes, put them in the rack, because I didn't want anybody to know I'd been there, you know. And so when I went to go back out my cardboard window, there was the Carson police standing there like that. And I just looked at him and I said, I'm not armed. He said, come on. So anyway, that was a whole debacle, and I went and they gave me 8 years. You know, the judge, he says, Lawrence, I can see that you've had a really rough childhood, and I can see that you've already done some time. And he said, I'm going to give you a break this time. What did you do last time? I said, 10. I'm only going to give you 8, but you're only going to have to serve half of it. And I was thinking, wait a minute. I did 4 on the 10. Well, it doesn't come out any better for me. But anyway, I mean, now I can say the man did the right thing. He did. I mean, nobody ever locked me up when I was succeeding in life. So, and then I got down to Jackson, and I got a timesheet. It said, well, it said 8 years, but then when I went to Buford prison, I got another one that said 3 years. I thought it was a typographical error, you know, so I wrote the public defender, you know, that represented. She said, oh, yeah. Right after you left the courtroom, we jumped all over the judge because he gave some guy 3 years for involuntary manslaughter. And we explained to him, this guy only took some peanut butter. So he cut mine to 3. So while I was there, and this is how this kind of comes into my experience with NABA. While I was at Buford Prison, I was sitting in my dormitory with all my buddies. And it was on a Sunday evening, I remember it was during the winter, and it was kind of dark out. And I heard them yell something. I didn't know what it was, but it was AA. And I asked the fellow next to me, I said, well, where are all these people going? And I said, well, there's an AA meeting in there. I said, well, what do they do? He said, well, some guy comes in and he brings speakers and he brings cake and cookies and coffee. And I thought, well, that's enough right there. I mean, because we didn't have that in the dorm. So the next Sunday I went out there, and there was a fellow named Kerbo who was leading this meeting. He had been doing it. He did it for 6 years altogether. But he took a special interest in me. I didn't have any interest in him, you know. I just wanted some cookies, and every now and then he'd bring a pretty girl, and that was enough. But he was kind of remarkable to me because he had tattoos all over him. And he had this big spongy afro, which y'all probably never saw, because y'all knew him as Woody. I knew him as Kerbo for the longest time. But anyway, I went to these meetings, and then I wrote this long letter to the parole board and explained to them that I was not a threat to society. I was merely a nuisance. And they bought it. And they sent me back down to that work release center. And so at the work release center down on Ponce Leon in Atlanta, I had already plotted out. I buddied up to the superintendent of the place, Mr. Quash. You never forget this guy. I said, Mr. Quash, I need to go see my family. He said, well, how long you need? I said, oh, about 6 hours. He said, all right, we'll do that. So then I called my buddies to get the stuff ready, because I wasn't going to see my family. I want to see them. And so I'm sitting there on my bunk waiting on my buddies to get there with the beer. And then somebody came in the room and said, you got a phone call. I said, who is it? Said, some guy named Mike. And one of my friends named him Mike. I thought that's who it was. So I went, I figured it was going to be late. So anyway, I get on the phone and he says, ready to go to the meeting? I said, well, who is this? He said, well, this is Mike. I said, why? Mike who? He said, Mike Kerbo. I said, okay, do I know you? He said, well, you know, from Buford. I said, well, do we do time together or something? He said, no, you know the AA meeting. I said, oh, what do you want? He said, well, you want to go to... I said, well, I'm going to see my family. He said, well, it's only going to take an hour. And then I'm thinking ahead. Because the only way to get out of work release center is either you go see your family every now and then, or you're going to look for a job, or you're going to a treatment center or some kind of 12-step meeting. They'll let you out. So I'm thinking, okay, if I go with him this time, he'll come a lot, and we can go to a lot of meetings, and I can be out of here. I said, all right. So he come over with some little rinky-dink, bombed-out car, and he drove me over here. And I remember it was a big birthday bash. It was young people's meeting, and I hated it. I just literally hated it. I mean, it was so bright and festive, and everybody was so happy and hugging, and that's not my experience. So when we were headed back, and it took a lot more than a damn hour, I can tell you that. So when we're headed back, he says, how'd you like it? I said, well, I couldn't relate to them people. They don't look like the kind of people, you know, I drank with. He said, well, that's all right. We'll go to a different one tomorrow night. I said, tomorrow night? He said, yeah. I said, you go every night? He said, yeah, sometimes twice. Okay, I get out of the treatment center. I mean, the work release center. So then the next night, he took me to Fred Norris's group over at GMHI. Everybody there was 80 years old. I mean, I couldn't relate to them at all. So we get out, and how'd you like that? I said, man, I can't relate to these people. He said, well, we'll go different tomorrow. I said, look, man. I said, won't you just give me your phone number, and I'll call you when I want to go. You sure? Yeah. So that's kind of the way that went for a while. I mean, I didn't hear from him again for a long time. So anyway, I got out of there, and a year and a half later, they got me for another one. I stole something. What did I steal? I can't remember what I stole anymore. But anyway, they gave me 10 due 5. So I'm doing a life on the installment plan. That's what they told me. And then I got classified as an habitual offender, which in the joint, that's big stuff. You got EH on your back. They don't mess with you. Back then, anyway, you know, there were only three of us in the whole prison that had EH. You know, that dude must have wasted some people. I mean, I was just a sneak thief, you know. So, while I was in there, they gave me a prestigious job right off, and then I screwed that up. And then they put me out on the road, you know, picking up the stuff. And I thought that was real beneath my station. Because, I mean, I can recite the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock without the book. And so one day we came in from the road, I just went past all authority and I went right into the assistant warden's office in there chomping on his cigar. And I said, look, dude, I need some help because I'm going to do this again. It's just going to happen again. I can tell you now, there ain't nothing changed. I got to have help. He said, well, what do you need? I said, well, I think I'm an alcoholic. He said, oh, we got an AA meeting. I said, yeah, I know you do. I said, but the two guys who chair it and the one that chairs it and the secretary are both practicing thieves on my wing, and I don't trust that group. He said, well, we'll put you in here with this. See, I done been through transaction analysis and Gestalt. I mean, I knew my life script. I was going around in circles. So he put me in an encounter group, touchy-feely little thing. But it did serve one big purpose. I had some skeletons, lots of them, sexual in nature. I know y'all don't have them. So, and they were eating me alive. So he kind of knew that. So he started telling me, I mean, this guy looked like Tarzan. He really did. He was looked like one of them Olympic swimmers. Big old joker. And he sat there and told me kind of a fifth step. He told me his experiences in life. And I thought, man, I don't believe I told that. So anyway, I started telling him. I didn't want to tell the rest of them, you know, sickos. But I told him, and that was good. Now, in the meantime, I wrote a letter to the Cab Addiction Clinic, which used to be on Briarcliff Road, and told them to put my letter up on the bulletin board, and it just basically said that I'm incarcerated and I would like to correspond with an alcoholic, yada, yada. So some fella named Jim V. from somewhere in South Georgia, he apparently had been going through DAC at the time, and he moved back shortly thereafter. Well, he sent me a whole package. He didn't send me a big book. He sent the 12 and 12, I guess postage probably. He sent me the 12 and 12 in every pamphlet. And so I proceeded to delve into the steps. And it's pretty easy. I mean, other than that 4 and 5, I didn't like those. That was for real sinners there. But anyway, I did do a four-step. I can pretty much tell you what it said. It was about a page and a half long, and it said the same thing. Each line said the same thing, and I just added a name. It said, I was an asshole too. And it went page and a half like that. And I didn't include the ones I was with. But it worked. So they finally let me out. You know, I wrote them a letter, explained to them. You know, I'm an alcoholic now. So they said, well, you probably are. So they sentenced me to the Cab Addiction Clinic, where I went, and I went through the 28-day program, and I was so terrified when I was coming up on my last days that I got a job as the janitor. so I could basically live there. And I became staff, and I learned a lot there, learned a great deal. Unfortunately, at $3.65 an hour, you know you have to move on eventually. Because my way of thinking was, how am I ever going to get a date working off of Marta? You know, I've done it, but not on a regular basis. So I bid them farewell, and at that point, then I began to actually go to AA meetings. And there was a fellow that was in the 28-day program with me, and we used to meet and have, we went everywhere. And I think we were at Parkwood Hospital. All I remember was it was a big cafeteria, and it was a speaker's meeting. I'm not a cafeteria, a gym. It was either Peachford or Parkwood or something. And he and I were sitting in the back of the room. There was a whole bunch of chairs. And I look up there and I see this big spongy dude. And I told him, I said, let me go up here and see if I know this dude. And at that time, I had not had a drink in 3 years. Oh, I forgot to tell you. Just before I was sentenced to this last 10 to 5, they gave me 3 days to get my affairs into order. My affairs consisted of a box of junk in my brother's closet. I had no bank account. I had nothing. That was it. I had a box of junk in my brother's closet. But my public defender thought I should have that. Because I remember the judge said, Lawrence, what affairs do you have? Do you think you can clear them up by Monday morning at 9 o'clock? I said, yeah. She said, Your Honor, my client would like 2 weeks. He said, no, that ain't happening. So I spent the whole weekend stealing wine out of the handy pantry. And I didn't even like wine. White wine. It was easy. It was right by the door. So in a basket on sale. So I went and turned myself in that Monday morning at 9 o'clock, and I stood right there outside. Some of you are familiar with the Cab County Jail. You got that little porch out there, and you look down there, and there's the windows where you tell them you want to visit your brother. And Monday morning, there was nothing but deputy sheriffs and turnkeys in there, and they were watching me, and I was out there smoking one of them big things with a tall Budweiser, two of them. And I sat there and looked at them, smoked it, and drank it. And then I drank the second one, and I remember cutting. I said, this is me. I crushed the beer can, and I looked at it, and I said, I don't want no more of y'all. And I threw it in the bush, and I went down, and I said, I'd like to turn myself in. And she said, for what? Public drunk? I said, no, burglary. She said, really? What? I said, I'm on the book. Read the book. So she got a book. She said, oh, Lawrence. I said, yeah, that's me. So, and they threw me in a holding cell, and some guy came in with an Army field jacket on, and he says, do you have a light? And I dug around, and I found some matches, handed it to him, and he found a little roach in his jacket. And you want a hit? I said, no, I quit. And I did. I haven't had any of that stuff since that moment. That was December the 7th. So anyway, when I got out of this whole thing and I was out again and I went through DAC and I worked there for a year, I was going to Clarkston piecemeal. I remember I still have a calendar from it. In 1984, I went to 9 months, I went to 99 meetings, which is not a meeting every day. But I was safe with all my counselors and clergy and nurses and other patients. And at the time that I left, I couldn't work there anymore. Then I became like the man who needed the life preserver. I was scared because I knew that I didn't have anything to fall back on. We did some kind of funny little art class, and I drew a box, a cube, with flowers bursting out of it. And we were supposed to interpret them. And I thought they were going to really love mine. And the therapist said, well, you know, it is beautiful. And she said, but you know, you don't have any soil and you don't have any roots and there's no foundation and they're all going to wilt. And you know what? That was profound because that was very true. And so I began to go over to Clarkston, and it probably took me, I don't know, another year before I actually got a sponsor. And I love my sponsor. My sponsor was fantastic. For 12 years I had this sponsor. When I went to Clarkston, I was in charge of cleaning up. That's what I was good at. I was cleaning the toilets, cleaning the floor, cleaning anything. I was your maintenance guy. And that was what I did. And then I began to chair meetings. But there came a day, I did not work the steps on alcohol per se. What happened was that I was working a job, and every day I went in, I was angry from the moment I got up to the time, well, I was angry all around the clock. And I kept calling my sponsor, telling him about it. And finally, one day, he said, you know, you need to grow up. He said, how about working the steps? I said, man, I'd do anything. Because it just feels like this is not fun. What's the whole point? You know, I'm not drinking. So I get up, I go to work, crappy job I don't like. And then I get off and I go to a meeting. And everybody's talking about steps and sponsors and inventories. And, you know, I go out to eat with them, and they just talk about steps and sponsors and inventories. And all I want to talk about is fishing and the weather and weird stuff. And they will talk about that for a minute, but they always get back around to steps and sponsors and service work. So I literally did go through the 12 steps in the order they're written. And the things that I was so resentful of, the things that ate me alive after I did the steps on this, the most amazing thing was I went to work and the same stuff happened on a daily basis, but it did not bother. It was almost like it was a movie and I was not a player in it. And that was an awakening there that even though stuff is happening around me really crappy, that it doesn't have to affect me. Although I can report since that time, I'm not as adept at identifying these things as I once was. But, so, went on and went to Clarkston for years and years, and then we formed another group over in Scottsdale. Married a girl in the program. Let's just say that didn't work out. We tend to pick that which we're ready for. And I did a big inventory when the divorce was over. And I sat there and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. And there was nothing in there on my part that I felt that a judge would say, well, there's a good reason for divorce. Everybody makes mistakes. But, I didn't do anything. I'd go cheat or do anything with money. I did the best I could. What happened was that after I read it over and over, I turned real red with embarrassment. I was by myself. I was red with embarrassment because I realized that I made my mistake in the choice. I chose someone who was just as sick as I. And that's embarrassing because I guess I'd been sober about 12 years at the time. You know, you're supposed to be all healed up by then. I'm still not healed. Over the years, I've been involved in the Coffee House Entertainers. Well, I'll invite you out here the 18th of October. We're doing the state. Done that many years. A lot of people think all we do is jump up on the stage and sing and dance and have a great time. I got news for you. The rehearsal's murder. You have to do the same thing over and over and over. But it's very worthwhile, and it's all it's a meeting. Justine W. told me one time, because we go to rehearsal, and we used to do it three or four nights a week, twice a night. And I'd say, well, I need to get to a meeting. She said, what the hell do you think this is? Because if you read the script, you see that it ain't nothing but the program. It's all about the steps. It's all about sponsorship. It's all about God's work. And there's few little things thrown in just for humor, but even they lend themselves to the precepts of the program. So I've been involved in that over the last couple of decades, on and off. When my son was born, I had to get out of it for a while. But we're doing it again this year for the state. And I think we're doing one down in Florida for their state convention. And it's a hoot. You know, I always love going to the state conventions because you get to meet people from all over the state. And it's just really cool. It's almost like a homecoming sometimes. You meet people you hadn't seen in a whole year. My first sponsor developed colon cancer and basically kind of dropped out of life. He didn't die. He just quit living. And he's, you know, it's sad because I had to go read him the Riot Act for his second wife. Tell him everything he'd always told me, and it didn't mean anything. And he's, as far as I know, still that way. So for a couple of 3 years, I basically went without a sponsor. Just, I mean, there were people with long-term sobriety that I kind of, Barbara A. and several people that I would talk to regular, but nobody I'd call sponsor. And then being in the Coffee House Entertainers, and Mike being there all the time, Curbo, Woody, y'all called him Woody. I finally started getting around to that, but I called him Mike mostly. And a lot of people never were aware of what Mike did. Just weren't. He was kind of picked on pretty regular here, and that kind of bothered me. But he did do a great deal for Alcoholics Anonymous throughout the state. And so I just asked him one day after rehearsal, I said, Mike, look, I don't have a sponsor and I need a sponsor. And that's when I began to call him Mike instead of Curbo, and because I had a great deal of respect for him. And when I got divorced, he took care of me. I didn't have any money. I mean, I was still paying mortgage and I was broke. And, of course, he snuck me in some meals down in the kitchen, you know, being the cook and all. And he would allow me to come in, and he'd give me money if I didn't have any. And he was a great friend. And so Woody died, which still hurts. Because, to be honest with you, I could be torn up. I mean, literally just whacked out, and I'd call him. And after talking with him a couple of minutes, it didn't bother me anymore. I mean, he was kind of goofy. And I believed him. See, that's the thing. You got to believe. And I believed him when he told me it would be all right. I mean, I called him. Somebody stole my car right out in front of my apartment. That was it. I called him up and I said, Mike stole my car. He said, all right, come on down here. I'll give you this van. I said, well, how much you want for it? Oh, you can have it. I said, no, I want to pay you for it. He said, no, he got bad brakes. He was right about that. $550 later, the brakes were fixed. But, I mean, it's the kind of guy he was. And he did all the artwork and stuff probably around here, but for the state conventions and used to the roundup and all kinds of things like that. And for the Coffee House Entertainers, he did the show cards and all the artwork and the flyers and the programs. And we miss him dearly. We still haven't found a drummer. And kind of like we don't want a drummer because he's still there. For me, we do songs we've done over the years, and he has certain little things he does during a song, and I can hear it in my mind when we're doing it. It's not there, but I can hear it. And it's a haunting kind of thing, and it reminds me of him. And sometimes when I'm upset, particularly when I go down Claremont, I don't know why I go down Claremont, I can hear him talking to me. And so today, when Woody died, I had to keep coming over here, you know, to get the whole thing. And so many people here treated me very well. And Terry said, you know, hell, why don't you just come be our new Woody? I said, well, I can't be it full time. He said, no, just come hang out and just bring us that piece of Woody that, you know, is gone, whatever you can bring. And so I just started coming, and particularly to the Tuesday night, 5:45, and I've been well received, and you know, there's certain people. Rusty, I've known Rusty ever since, God, not Rusty, way back in the dark ages, back over to Mill, and Bud, and just so many. Bruce has been very, very nice to me, and I really like it over here. And I had a thought today in the shower. I said, you know, if Bill and Bob visited Nava, they'd feel terribly comfortable. They just would. This would be the kind of place they'd like to be at, with the mix, the old-timers and the newcomers, and I think they'd be very comfortable with it. There's probably 20 million things. I always thought, well, if I'm 25 and I tell my story, or I'm 55 and I tell my story, if you're older, why don't you get more time to tell it? I mean, if you're 15 and you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, why should it take you a full hour? Either I get more or they get less. But that's my story, and there's a lot more of it, but I'll share it with y'all over the years, right, you know, in the meetings. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony. We actually gave you two, but you served one. Thanks for a good hour. Seventh tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Donations support the group at AA at Zone. Give till it hurts. I've asked Dr. W. to give out the chips.
Has a ring. Good evening, friends. I'm Willis, and I am a grateful recently recovering alcoholic. Thanks. We have a chip system here. I apologize for my inexperience in this, but we have a white chip of surrender. If you'd like to join our way of life, hopefully for at least 24 hours, but for whatever amount of time that you can accomplish that. Would anyone like a white chip?